Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, as I normally am, and I'm joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Nick. Sunny Cape Town, enjoying the
stuff. It's also
fine weather.
Surprisingly windy up here in Joburg, which is not common for us. And of course, we are also joined by our agent in Pretoria, Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I must say that if we were to define the weather by premiers, then I think Gauteng would be Alan Windy.
You know, I'm tempted to just leave dead air there just so that our listeners can sit there and suffer with the consequences of that horrible pun. But anyway, time is short and we must go on with the serious business of the day. And that is unusual sometimes for this show, but an excellent first story. Some good news. In fact, we've got a little bit of good news today in this the show. And that is that the Pretoria High Court has ruled against lots of very important aspects of the mining charter. So the mining charter was this piece of sort of regulation created by the Department of Minerals and Energy, or whatever it's called these days, that effectively was governing the way that the mining sector in South Africa worked. And one of the issues that was very contentious in the its BEE regulations in particular was this idea of once empowered, always empowered. So the way that the regulations have been written seem to suggest that a company would have to always maintain a certain level of BEE ownership. In this case, I think it's around 26% or 30%. And that if the black shareholders sold their stake and that percentage dropped to, let's say, 10%, the company would have to give away their shares again until such a time as they complied once again with those regulations. In other words, it created such a situation where there was almost like a revolving door. Someone could be empowered with BEE shares and then simply sell them, and the company would have to fork out to do the whole thing all over again, which, as you can imagine, was not a great investment incentive. So the Pretoria High Court has ruled that this is not the case, and that once you've given away a certain percentage of your company, it doesn't matter what happens to those shares, if they're sold, if they're bought by someone else or whatever, the company can consider itself as having complied with the legislation. There was also other parts to this judgment, which, me not being much of a legal eagle, don't fully grasp, but essentially that the ruling says that the Department of Minerals can't make legislation, which is what it says that it was effectively doing. It has to go through Parliament, and it has to actually pass things through Parliament. Imagine that, using the legislature for its purpose. Yeah. So let me start with Herman. Herman, what do you make of this? Seems like a good thing to me. Seems like a triumph for business and making mining and doing business in South Africa easier, which, of course, more jobs and all more tax, all that good stuff.
Yeah, no, I must say, and everyone get your, you know, drum sets and your hi-hats ready, this undermines BEE in a way, in the sense that it really sort of kills one of the core tenets that has made BEE such a toxic, perpetual drag on the economy. And in a weird, perverse way, it has made it more difficult. Let's grant, for, you know, sake of argument, that there's some merit in forcing a company to abandon control of some of its shares to create a black middle class. There isn't, but let's, for sake of argument, say there is some merit to that. What this bizarre idea of that you can lose your BEE status or your empowerment status or whatever would entail is that it makes it more difficult for the black middle class that you've just empowered through shares to actually sell their shares, because they can only sell it under certain strict circumstances where they wouldn't undermine this BEE rating. It's similar to the story we will get to in a bit where with Burger King. The moment the government says, black people, we are forcing you to keep ownership of these shares, what you're essentially saying is that entrepreneurial black industrialists or asset managers or people who play the stock market can choose the right time to invest or disinvest from whatever enterprises. So perversely, despite the fact that it is based on a terrible assumption that you can just conjure wealth into being, it also undermines the few people who might actually be legitimately economically empowered by share ownership, because the share ownership becomes subject to government fiat, so they can't necessarily use them to make the investments return, give them a return that they want. So I think it's absolutely perverse. It is a small crack. And I do think in the last year, we're seeing these small cracks and we shouldn't miss them nor oversell them. We've seen a few small cracks in the hegemonic approach of state control collapsing. I think the Kgetheleng River municipality judgment was significant, where a municipality can be held liable for services not delivered. I think that's a good advance. Then you've got the BEE starting to even people like Ferrell Huffergy during last year's COVID peak panic, saying that, BEE during a time of crisis isn't good. Well, then the thought that BEE during a time of less crisis is perhaps also. So there are these small cracks emerging that we should acknowledge and see, that's the opportunity where we should keep on letting that hammer fall. And perhaps just a last bit on the legal point is you've got a few levels of law that can be made in a country. At the top of it, you've got the constitution. So you've got constitutional law elements that defines the broad scope of rights and state functioning. And then below that, you've got parliamentary legislation or primary legislation. Then below that, you've got secondary legislation or delegated powers, where regulations can be given to certain entities or ministers to give effect to primary legislation, like the Mineral Resources Whatever Act. And the problem comes in when an act gives so much power to a minister that it essentially bypasses parliament. But that's not quite what happened here. What happened here was that the act passed by parliament was interpreted by the ANC to give these broad powers to the minister to make rules by which the industry must abide. And then the court just found so essentially the minister tried to make parliamentary level legislation binding on the level of parliamentary legislation without actually going through parliament. So that's just a bit of the hierarchy of legislation there. I don't know if it's useful.
No, that's very useful to a fool such as I. That's very, very useful to know. Michael, so I guess, we're sort of, what this case I think has done is kind of really sort of begun to get into the heart of what is envisioned by proponents of BEE. There's, I think, you can almost see that the court judgment is creating two versions of how the BEE policy should be implemented. There's the sort of soft version, which basically says BEE is about giving people an opportunity and creating a sort of payment system where those who once had wealth now give it to people who were disadvantaged in the past, I mean, at least in theory. And once they've done that, then those people are basically free to participate in the economy. However, and then there's another version which says the purpose of BEE is to make society look exactly like our spreadsheet, that it must have X number of this race, X number of this race. And when they use a word like transformation, they mean literally that society must be transformed to look exactly as we envision it. It's a sort of social engineering of ambition that we haven't seen since the 1960s in this country, perhaps. What do you make of all that, Michael?
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. And but I think what both it really actually overlook is the scope of economic activity actually, if it's allowed to occur without being trammeled by dicta and legislation and so on, to spread that benefit far wider. And this really is the kind of key point here, is that, you can step in and attempt to direct and limit and control investment and who has it. But in fact, it's the investment itself, the economic activity itself that is liberating. That's really what we ought to be focusing on. And that's measurable in millions of jobs and livelihoods right across the economy. And in terms of mining, obviously far beyond, the pits and shafts of the industry. This particular issue, I think, is a significant win for us because we've been arguing about this for a long time. I just happened to look up this morning, 2.5 years ago, the IRR produced a report, Mining Charter, an Improvement, but Transformation Still Trumps Sustainability was the title. And just, some basic elements of this argument is the press release at the time began with this very simple point that less government interference in the mining industry will enable it to contribute much more effectively towards overcoming South Africa's three critical enemies, poverty, unemployment, and inequality. And the fundamental point is that it's through the business of mining, exploiting the country's very rich and largely untapped mineral resources. We keep hearing about this. It's I forget the numbers now and how we compare, but we're up there with Russia and Australia, perhaps even bigger than either of them. It's through the business of doing that rather than by trying to meet onerous standards or onerous requirements, empowerment, and other obligations, that this sector would be free to actually contribute to the economy and growing jobs and so on. So, yeah, I mean, to the limited extent that this is this particular aspect of it, the permissibility of regarding the initial BEE deal as one that lasts throughout the operation of the mine, has been accepted. This is again, but beneath that is this really fundamental argument. I was just thinking, as Herman was telling us or talking about, the extent to which some of these do-gooding gestures actually harm people who now have an asset but find themselves unable to trade it because there's some legislative impediment to it. In a radio interview a little while ago, actually discussion on radio about property rights, the host turned to me and said, But isn't the risk of giving black people property rights that they'll go out and sell their houses tomorrow? And, the obvious question is, well, why should you want to stop them? Why should they not be free to do what everybody else in a free society does? They have an asset, and if they want to sell it, they sell it. And it's exactly that sort of idea that somebody knows better and can tell an industry or investors or workers how to behave.
Yeah, it's a sort of mad, crazy thing that just seems to keep happening in South Africa, which is we go through all this trauma because the law treats people differently on the basis of their race, treats property owners differently based on what color their skin is. And then once we abolish that system, the government goes, "Hi, you know what we really need is to put that system back, but just change the details here and there so that we can... We can reverse it." I mean, it's kind of missing the point. Anyway, yeah. And of course we'll continue that on our second topic there. But Herman, any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just think and Nick, you a few months ago put me onto this train of thought, and I'm still going where the tracks tried to lead me. Is this key element of value add? That the real problem with things like BEE is it does not add value. It demands someone get something without putting in, and the risk of nonsense policies like BEE, and as someone in the comments pointed out, blatant elite enrichment, and the IRR started calling it that a while ago, and I think we should keep on calling it that. The real risk is that it becomes this notion of BEE actually led to black people gaining commercial positions of power, then came failure, therefore black people can't be trusted or are not competent enough to actually be in financial, corporate, influential roles, where the problem is that those people, while they may be black, got there through no value add. Were they to gain those positions of influence and sector leadership through value add, essentially earning their stripes, then you would get this industrial class of a new black middle class coming in with value add solutions. But the real problem is that BEE is a net value detractor. It has cost us almost 2 trillion rand since the instigation of BEE as government policy for businesses to comply with BEE regulation. That's 2 trillion rand that did not go to salaries of productive workers. That did not go to useful taxes. That's just wasted money because some regulations needed to be adhered to without for a second considering that actually something needed to be given. The economy needs to be made stronger. And it comes back to that what a former cabinet minister once let slip to France is that the ANC's real hope is sustainable wealth extraction. And there is no such thing. Wealth extraction hits a black pit at some point. And I think South Africa is seeing the consequences now.
Exactly. Anyway, let us move on to our second story, which is in many ways very similar to the first. And that is also good news, but with a bit of a twist as well that's not 100% there. So, of course, we talked in an episode, I think a couple of months ago, actually, about the attempt to sell Burger King. The local South African franchise wanted to sell the sort of Burger King to a foreign company. And this was blocked by the Competition Commission, which said that this couldn't be allowed because the percentage of black ownership would drop from, I think it was about 68% to zero. So they said, we can't allow this merger to happen because there is no, as they say, public interest in it happening. So effectively, the commission there had said that black people were not allowed to sell their property because they're selling it to the wrong kind of person, which is obviously madness. But anyway, so that decision has now been reversed. The Competition Tribunal has given the green light to the acquisition of Burger King South Africa by a private equity fund. The current license owner, Grand Parade Investments, will now be selling the brand to Pan-African private equity firm Emerging Capital Partners. However, they attached the Competition Tribunal attached certain stipulations to the deal, and these are the following: that Burger King must procure an investment of no less than 500 million rand in aggregate capital expenditure, establishing at least 60 new Burger King outlets in South Africa, which will increase the number to 150, increasing the number of permanent Burger King employees by at least 1,250 historically disadvantaged persons, increasing the total value of all payroll and employee benefits in respect of these new employees by not less than 120 million rand, and improving its rating for the enterprise and supplier development element under its BBBEE scorecard. So, Michael, once again, am I right in my assessment that it's a bit of a victory, but these conditions, I mean, you know, I'm pleased because I'm going to have more Burger Kings to go to, but I'm not terribly sure that the company or the economy will be pleased by this.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, once again, I think as in mining, we see here again this profoundly flawed conception that overlooks the significance of what a thriving, successful economy is. And it's one in which people are free to make trades and choices as they see fit and as they judge is best for them. That we know, it's not an article of faith. It's something we can observe in the world. And you know, so many more people would benefit if that were allowed to happen in any particular case, but certainly in this one, I would imagine that if you say to companies, you buy and sell as you see fit based on your financial assessment and the risk you're prepared to take or whatever it might be. And I think, you know, in 2021, with 44% unemployment on the expanded definition, it ought to be scandalous, actually, that the government is even contemplating making it effectively more difficult for people to put money into the economy. And so here again, you know, we've wasted a hell of a lot of time with this thing. I think the initial deal was turned down in June, if I'm not mistaken, this year. And the wording you alluded to it, the proposed merger cannot be justified on substantial public interest grounds, which, you know, it really is just a shocker. So, yeah, we waste a lot of time. Values have fallen. Potential jobs at risk and so on. So it is scandalous actually, but nevertheless we see here a slight advance in the kind of thinking maybe.
So Herman, defenders of the conditions set out by the competition tribunal would say no, Michael's completely wrong here, because what we've done is we've actually secured more jobs. There's 1,250 additional jobs being given to people that we feel are the most deserving of employment in South Africa, that being historically disadvantaged persons. And we've also extracted a certain amount of investment from the company. So how is this anything but a win for South Africa?
Well, as I mentioned rather irreverently before we started recording, was I think if that line of thinking has any merit, the government should just pass a law saying unemployment is illegal, and that, you know, going bankrupt as a business is illegal.
The Soviet Union made unemployment illegal, I think.
Yes, and I mean all strength to their overall production line. But the thing is that I almost did a very, very bad agricultural based Russia pun. If you want to get I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there. No, I am. If you want to get someone to invest in the Russian agricultural economy, you must do something to attract her. And that is probably, in this case, female investor. Okay, law. Anyway, okay, so what I would say to those people is that you can't just stipulate that there should be new jobs. Let there be jobs. Because in a country like South Africa, you have a lot of demand for things, for services, for goods, for food, for opportunities. So you have half or at least a third of the equation of what would be necessary for rapid economic expansion. But you don't just need demand for goods and services. What you also need is the purchasing power, people able to actually have enough money, have enough assets that they can go out into the marketplace and say, I need this, that person provides it. I will then use the assets to my disposal in exchange for those goods and services. You can't just then suddenly say, let there be more jobs, because the problem is you need to empower people first to justify those jobs in existing. You can't just say, you know, we stipulate there must be new businesses here, here, and here. Because the problem is people need to actually say, there are businesses there, there, and there. I want to go there. Therefore, I will exchange what I've put my time into in return for an income into a productive exchange relationship with that business. What the Competition Commission here is just, it's really the Marie Antoinette type of economic thinking. You know, just let there be economic activity. Let them, you know, eat burgers. We're not at that stage yet. And I think if we really want to look seriously at this, I am one of those people, a free market capitalist, who would stand up for the existence of something like the Competition Commission. I do think unfettered capitalism gives rise to some very, very dangerous extortionist behavior from your Facebooks, your Google, your really big companies that start owning such a dominating market share that they make it impossible for competition to find a fair footing. So I have a lot of sympathy with the conceptual existence of the Competition Commission. This is nonsense. This is utter nonsense. They were not stimulating competition here. They were advancing political agendas. And it was Ludwig Erhard, the West German economics minister, responsible for the miracle of the West German recovery after the Second World War, that essentially made the point that if you are in a position where you want a free market, you have to be vigilant against two enemies of the free market, an overpowerful state and an overpowerful corporate sector. And for that, a competition commission does make some sense, but only if the motivation of its actions is to stimulate competition. And that is not what it did here. There's nothing competitive about this decision. It's pushing a transformationist agenda that benefits no one. In fact, people are now less likely to invest. People cannot share their assets in exchange for valuable things that they want. It's just moronic. It's stupid. And the fact that that was sort of acknowledged is a bit of a win, but we must press our advantage.
No, exactly. Anyway, I'm very glad because I thought that Burger King might have to liquidate itself. That was, I think, the fear because it just wasn't making the money that the company needed. So I'm very glad that it will remain because I am a big fan of Burger King, as one can see by my corpulent figure. Anyway, let us go on to the next topic, which is a thing that made international news a while ago, and that was this company called Theranos. Now, I will let Herman feed you more of the details, but my understanding of it is that this was a medical science blood testing company that said that it had managed to create an incredibly revolutionary new way of testing people's blood for various things, and this turned out to be false. And now there's a trial where the founder of the company and one of the other major executives is facing fraud charges. Herman, tell us the story.
Yeah, so that's in essence what happened is this MIT dropout, I think it's MIT, I can't remember, Elizabeth Holmes, really charismatic, seemingly sociopathic individual with this people skills and charisma, announced this revolutionary idea to the world that a very simple medical device can do hundreds of blood tests within a very short time and at a very low cost. And this was such an intriguing prospect. And her personality was such that she got really big shot American politicians and former politicians to buy into this. Former secretaries of state, I think the Clintons invested in this. So very, very shortly, Elizabeth Holmes just became the youngest billionaire in Silicon Valley, or female billionaire. I can't remember what exactly the label was, but it was a label and well done. But then it turned out that this was completely sold on a false prospectus. What Holmes and her company, Theranos, started selling as, this is a company worth investing. We've got this high level of tech that can really do amazing things at a minuscule cost. Turned out it couldn't. The technology just wasn't there. And why I find this story fascinating is it is the perfect illustration of, I think, a point that I made a few minutes ago, that there's a real danger to a free market when powerful political interests align with corporate greed. Three great evils, I think, of any free market economy aspirations are big labor, big business, and big government. And this is an instance where two of those collaborated, where the politicians and government officials believed the lies coming from this corporate entity, empowered them significantly, and then turned out not to be true. If there was a real market competition there, Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos would have gotten nowhere. But the fact that these politicians bought into this, that they were put by their political careers in a position of such lobbying influence, that democracy in America became a professionalized career, sort of citizen responsibility or involvement as was originally envisioned, meant that this whole thing could become a manipulation of power politically and financially. And that's blown up now in people's faces. And thank goodness there are consequences, but I just think it's a perfect illustration of where big government and big corporate align for a bit of personal greed. The small guy always pays the price.
Michael, what do you make of the story? Do you agree with the way that Herman has framed it?
Yes, I think pretty much. I haven't followed it, and it's a pretty complex story. The woman, I think, was actually a dropout from Stanford, Herman, but the facts don't alter the outcome at all.
One of them fancy universities like our colleague Gabriel Krauser.
Indeed. But I think, I mean, something that does occur to me with, as an extension of Herman's concerns about, or he's highlighting the risk of big business and big government sort of converging or colluding in this way, is also, you know, the idea that this kind of story could demonstrate, for instance, the failure of capitalism, which some detractors might attempt to do. And of course, it bears out the very basic truth, which a lot of people find it difficult to appreciate, is that capitalism on its own automatically doesn't guarantee the best outcome always. It doesn't guarantee a better utopia than a state-led utopia. But what it does incorporate in all its contending freedoms is a much more likely, quicker capability to change and to have to adjust, to have to confront things. And so in this particular case, it's interesting, you see the scientists and journalists who are the ones who began to ask questions. And this all occurs within the very environment of a free society, a democracy, a capitalist society. It doesn't mean that the mistakes are ruled out. They will most assuredly happen, as is the case with anything anything earthly at all. But we see here the dynamics of the solutions as well: justice, free courts, good journalism, and solid science all coming to bear and exposing things that go wrong.
Excellent. And with that, we must close because we are already over time. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Fringe show. Have a great one, everyone.